Welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the program where history is gained through the analysis of pop culture. Today's episode's on the shorter side, but the topic itself is rather large. My drop-in guest, Gloria, wished to talk about music related to the Great Migration of the 20th century. And we did, but we also found ourselves covering a great many other topics related to the mass movement of African Americans from the Southeast to points north and west between 1910 and 1970. Take a listen. All right, I'm here with Gloria at the National Council for the Social Studies Conference in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City. And I've been talking a lot of music today, which makes perfect sense because we are in Nashville and that's where so much is made. Have you had a chance to check out some of the music of Nashville so far?
I haven't. I feel very sheepish about that. In fact, I've only ever passed through Nashville, but I'm really excited to find some piece of Dolly Parton merch, and I'll be happy if I can manage that.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll have no trouble finding a place that's willing to sell it.
I'm hoping for maybe a Tennessee Ernie Ford moment, too, because...
I love Lucy.
I love Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Wait, but have you ever seen the Lucy episode with him on it?
I love Lucy. I haven't.
Oh, that's the only way I know him, originally.
Really? Okay.
Because he plays her cousin.
I didn't know that.
He totally goes into like the country rube thing and is like goes to New York City where she lives, and he ends up like moving in with them, and Ricky gets so sick of him that they try to find a way to get him out. It's a hilarious episode.
I can't believe I didn't know that.
He strikes a deal with them that he'll leave if they perform with him on some country music jamboree show.
Yeah, because Ricky in the show, he has a club, right?
Right, and he's a musician. Okay. And so you see them playing the washboard, and you should look it up.
I will.
But yeah, he is an accomplished...
I mean, I imagine... I'm surprised I haven't seen more of him, given his name.
Yeah.
It's right there. Like,
they kind of have to, right?
Yeah.
I had a Nashville moment last night, where I'd only been in town for 3 hours, and I was looking for something to eat, and right by the hotel was this place called The Row Kitchen and Bar, and they did the traditional Nashville thing where it's like constant music.
Every hour,
a new artist gets on stage, and they do their thing and for tips, and then the next artist comes on. It was really incredible. So we're talking about music, and specifically the Great Migration.
Yes.
And are you of the mindset that there were two great migrations in the 20th century surrounding both world wars, or are we leaning more towards the Second World War Great Migration?
You know, that is the question, isn't it? When I learned it, I didn't learn it in school. It was like one slide in U.S. history. But when I was learning about it, I was looking at it through a far greater scope. So in my mind, when I was in school, being a nerd by myself, learning about this, it was, you know, turn of the century and analyzing it all the way into the 70s.
Yeah.
So I would probably say that I look at it at a far larger scale. But I can see that there were waves.
Right. I guess that's the way I should put it, because you're right. The early 20th century, there was quite a bit of debate going on, mm-hmm. mostly in the press, newspapers, trying to keep black people in the South, saying, you know, the North doesn't understand you, they're going to treat you poorly, you know, you at least know the way things work down here.
Yeah.
And then the Northern press, mainly from like NAACP and other, saying, but at least up here you get to make your own way.
Yes.
You don't have to go with what...
Yeah. What comes to mind is Ida B. Wells. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with her story.
Well, why don't you share it right now?
For sure. So, if I recall correctly, Memphis was her birthplace, Yellow Springs, maybe. But much of her early career as a journalist was in Memphis. She had a newspaper called The Free Speech and Headlight. And it was actually the lynching of three of her grocer friends that was a huge turning point for her. And she went on to move to Chicago and continue her advocacy work there, along with a lot of movement in the South, because she did a lot of exposés on the lynch mob culture of the South at the time. So she was a massive voice for advocating for self-determination through movement. And that's why ultimately I associate her with the Great Migration, because she was one massive figure of the Great Migration. So you can actually see a mural of her in Memphis. And I made a point to pass by Memphis on my way to Indiana the first time so I could see that. But also you can go up to Chicago and see where she lived. And now nowadays she's more recognized. Like, I found out from a student actually that she has a Barbie after her.
Oh, really?
Which is crazy. But for a very long time, her legacy went sort of under the radar. But yes, that's exactly what would come to mind. Because you have an actual Black voice telling the masses through her independently run newspapers, and she also was a big pamphlet girl, woman, I should say. My Gen Z is shredding through. But yeah, she was huge on pamphlets, and because it was her voice, like a very reputable source in the eyes of Black America, she represented, you know, a more reliable narrative on what it means to have that movement as a Black American in the 20th century, and whether what everyone is saying is true, was true, I should say. So yeah, can you tell I love talking about the Great Migration?
Do. Well, you know, and honestly, what I'm getting from this is a lot of different corridors. I know we only have a few minutes, but a lot of different avenues to go down.
Yeah.
And to treat things like primary sources, because have they ever made any kind of movie or TV program about Wells, or as far as you know?
So I remember as an eighth grader, I watched a documentary. It must have been from the 80s about her. But I think that's the extent of it, which I find unbelievable, because her life story just is incredible. Mm-hmm. She was a school teacher, and then she was a journalist. And then she toured through Europe telling people the realities of lynch mob violence in the United States. She did so much in her life. And her legacy, I think, is finally becoming recognized. But no, I don't see her in popular culture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess documentaries technically would still fit under the same category of, like, why did they make it? What material did they make it out of? You
know, and I would say her family legacy is a huge part of that, advocating for her story. Yeah.
Because it's still a pretty big undertaking to make a documentary. Maybe not the same skill set as a feature film, but it still takes quite a bit of effort.
Yeah.
And so, and maybe even more in the category of research and stuff. So it's like,
yes,
that tells you something about the time period. But sometimes it's like, all right, we've had how many movies after this person? But none about this other person, and what's the deal? And I think that when those stories do come up, speaks volumes about the time and place. So, like, as an example, like most states, New Hampshire has its historic markers all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And we, I think, have a pretty unique set of them, everything from, because it's actually pretty easy to make one of those signs. You just need, like, I think, 100 signatures.
Really?
And you write up and you provide the research and you submit it to the state and they put it up. You know, they put it in a plaque. Like, just a few weeks ago, they, in Dover, the city I teach in, they put one up for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh my God.
They were created there.
Really? Okay.
In an apartment in Dover in 1983. And so that, and then they also have up in Lincoln, New Hampshire, the site where Betty and Barney Hill claim to have been abducted by a UFO.
Oh my God.
But that one does actually have a little bit more seriousness to it, because Barney Hill, they were an interracial couple, Betty and Barney Hill. And
I'm not familiar.
So it's a pretty famous story of, they were traveling back to Portsmouth, New Hampshire from Canada. They'd visited Montreal. And as they were in the White Mountains, they claimed that they saw these lights following them. And then at one point, this craft was in front of them, and they got out of their car, and then they returned to their car, but hours had gone by, and their clothes was messed. He was missing his watch. Something was...
Yeah. And they, something was off.
But they didn't say anything about it for a while. They even kept it from friends and families. And part of that had to do with... So Barney, he was a Black man, and he... he was pretty well involved with the NAACP local chapter around there, so he had some status in the society. He was a mailman, you know, so he was a, you know, and that's civil service, you know, not the kind of jobs or roles that you want to go around, hey, I got abducted by space aliens,
yeah.
You know? And so they didn't talk about it for a while, but then when they finally did, you had like, it almost branched off in two directions. Some people took it very seriously,
yeah,
and were like, we, tell us more. They like, we need to hypnotize them and interview them, and mm-hmm. they did do that. And then the other direction of, you know, like, let's make it pop culture. Like, he ended up on To Tell the Truth, that game show. I found a footage of that. Of the, I'm Barney Hill. No, I'm Barney Hill. And they made a movie with James Earl Jones played him.
Okay.
And that was in the 70s. It was a made-for-TV thing. I wouldn't be surprised if they made another one soon.
Yeah?
What I was going with this, though, is that a couple years ago, there was a wave of these signs that went up, and most all of them were women history, things from like the 20s and the 30s, but they were, and I'm like, well, that makes sense because in the last 10 years or so, we've seen a revolution in telling women's stories from history.
Yes, yeah.
So even though the signs look all the same as the ones that went up 40 years ago, 50 years ago, depicting something from another time and place, right next to them or down the street from them are ones that were put up in 2020s about women. And so it's like slowly but surely populating all the stories. So even if Ida B. Wells doesn't get a movie, doesn't mean that she can't be represented
Absolutely.
In other forms. So we sat here today, we're going to talk about music.
Yes.
And since it's the word migration, we have to talk about how did music migrate? What music comes to mind when you think Great Migration?
That is a beautiful question, because I would argue, and I did argue as a 14-year-old making my school project about it, and it was a documentary actually, I argued that all music that we saw, especially in the United States, but given our global world, across the planet, could be traced back in some way to the interactions that are happening during the Great Migration. So we see old hymns, like classic gospel, that could be found on plantations, and the influence that had, and the way it traveled up the Mississippi River, and evolved to what we would then call blues, up to Harlem, where jazz absolutely exploded during the Harlem Renaissance. Even down to influences of what we would now call rock and roll. And rock and roll, of course, influences pop music, and all the things that, you know, I think we would hear on the radio today outside of, you know, the classical music station, if that's what you're into, which is valid. But a lot of it can be traced to that movement and to the way that physical mobility also translated to social mobility. So what comes to mind would be Motown, Berry Gordy Jr., himself, the founder, the father of Motown, had his own Great Migration story. And then we have stories like, you know, so many icons, the Supremes, Diana Ross, the Jackson 5, a lot of people who would really define an era of music that would also go on to be integrated into culture that was also accepted by white Americans. And I mean, we're in Nashville.
Yeah.
That influence can't be understated, because as it traveled up north and west, we also got a feedback loop back into the southern states, and we got to see how that influenced country music. And I would argue that that influence is under reported on, but very much present, especially with the gospel connection.
Yeah. It's almost, I like that you said that feedback component to it. It's I oftentimes, because I'm weirdly obsessed with the Erie Canal.
Everyone has their thing.
Yeah, that's my thing. It's kind
Valid.
Of,
yeah,
unfortunately, that's not the most fantastic, but I like it. And
someone's gotta.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what I'm saying.
I'm like the Erie Canal's best friend. I love my wife, my in-laws, they're from one of the many ports along the Erie Canal. And so every New Year's we get, or Christmas time, we get an Erie Canal calendar. Beautiful photography.
Yeah.
Along the canal. But
And that's movement. That
right.
represents
it's,
movement.
And every single place along, I mean, the thing that's called the mother of cities, because it's not just the cities in New York State that were built from it, but the cities across the Great Lakes.
Yeah.
Even New York City owes its existence as a financial capital to the Erie Canal. And but what the canal really did, when you look at it in a map and kind of like follow it to the Great Lakes and then to the Mississippi River and Mississippi River down to New Orleans,
yeah,
and the Gulf of Mexico, it makes this big loop.
Mm-hmm.
It makes this system, this whole American system. And so you're talking about the music coming up by way of people moving mm-hmm. from the south to the north up the Mississippi. And I mean, I'm sure it wasn't Highway 61, US 61, that like finally we have a road. It's like
yeah.
no, there was roads along the yes. Mississippi. So,
and
know,
those boats cannot be underestimated in the role they played.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Moving people, mm-hmm. exposing them to new places, new things, new ideas.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I guess what we're ultimately coming down to is that this is a story of the natural waterways, transportation ways
absolutely.
Of America, which had always been there, built upon, utilized, embedded into other, you know, so like the Transcontinental Railroad.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, the terminus of so many of those eastern lines was the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And then a new railroad began and would bring them further out west. And so it's like that is just transferring culture. Everything's going in every single
absolutely.
Direction. And it happens in music, it happens in literature.
In language.
It's in language, it's happened in movies. I always like to bring this up, that the movie industry, Rochester, New York, which is one of those Erie Canal cities, is where Kodak
oh,
is
wow.
headquartered. That's where they make all the film. Not anymore, because it's all digital,
yeah.
but...
I mean, but...
Hollywood...
Looking back, I can see that is
all the movie
massive.
That Hollywood...
Yeah.
All the film that Hollywood used came from Rochester. And so they'd send it out to California, they'd put something on it, and then... I always enjoyed watching movies in Rochester, because it's like, hey... Yeah, you did good with this stuff that we, yeah, that they
full
sent
circle.
Out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, tied the loop closed.
And so similarly, with like if, you know, somebody were to go to the Gibson Guitar Factory and, you know, like play a song for them, like, hey, so I did with your product. Pretty
yeah.
good, right? You know, here's
yeah.
my record that I made.
Would
so.
They develop it back in New York?
So sometimes, if you like watch old episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, they'll say like, the photo experts were called in Rochester, New York, and we sent the, you know,
okay.
and they would do that research. Actually, the Eastman Museum in Rochester, so George Eastman founded Kodak, is based on, they have a movie collection. So they curate film, and they house a lot of film. They resurrect it. So I don't know if they actually... did much with the movie industry at the time,
mm.
but as far as storage and care and resurrecting some of it, because a lot of that stuff got damaged, they repair it in Rochester and store it how it should be. They archive it, and so they have very, I would say, very scholastic ways of presenting it back. It's like, we're going to have a screening of, you know, the 1932 Three
yeah.
Stooges tonight. You know, it's like...
And that's an underappreciated, I mean... almost invisible aspect of this. My sister is huge on recognizing the importance of libraries. She's huge on information preservation. And I think many people, particularly in America, we can just go through our lives without thinking about what it takes to preserve the past.
Yeah.
And we as history educators, we can appreciate that history isn't the past, it's our reconstructions of it through sources.
That's
and
so excellently put, by the way. That's such a.
Thank you.
I'm going to save that spot forever. That's so good.
Thank you. And, I mean, this is how I can best keep this alive for my students, because my students know Michael Jackson. And if I can tell them the story of how Michael Jackson was first part of the Jackson 5 and how his family were involved.
Gary, Indiana.
Exactly.
Great Migration, I'm sure.
I mean, a huge hub for the Great Migration.
Yeah.
And I think bridging that gap and making it quote-unquote real is all I can ask for. And you talk about, you asked if anyone had made a movie about Ida B. Wells. And that aspect of not only the history itself, Ida's life, but the way we tell the stories. I always bring up historiography because I love historiography.
I love it too.
Analyzing those secondary sources as well, and what we can learn about a period of history through the secondary sources of earlier periods, and it just all loops back together.
Yes, you're totally speaking my language here. This is great. I love doing that.
Yes,
because
same.
I remember taking a historiography class in graduate school, and it took a little while to really catch on what they were getting at.
Crazy.
But once I hooked, I'm like, that is wonderful, because like what you just said, that statement that I said was so good moments ago, I'm like, that's actually right. The history of 1910, you know, the way they told history was influenced by the way that they went about it then.
Absolutely.
And our history is going to be looked at in 100 years the same way. We're going to be like, oh, this is how they did things in 20, you know, some dopey guy, you know, talked to people in a, you know, conference on his podcast. And,
absolutely.
You know, it's all kind of, it just cycles back into itself. And this has just been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
I want to say about the as we're talking, it reminded me when I was in like 7th or 8th grade, we had to, in English class, we had to read biographies. And
I remember doing that as well.
Yeah, it must be something about that age. Like, you're going to learn about people, like individual. I read about Joe Louis, the boxer. And I remember now that he was born in Alabama or somewhere in the South, and it talks about how he moved to Detroit, you know, for his family, his dad or something got a job at one of the plants there. And I think it was right around World War I. And so, and then, you know, long story short, at least for a time, I don't know if it's still true, that's where the hockey and the basketball team would play, was Joe Louis Arena, because he went off to be a boxer. And, you know, boxing tends to be kind of a lower class sport. You know, it's not,
yes,
it's not up there with, you know, cricket and polo and,
yeah,
and bullfighting. It's more like
lacrosse or something.
Right, two guys punching each other until one knocks out. I mean, it's like a barroom brawl.
Blood,
you know,
spraying everywhere.
More organized.
Yeah.
But he made his name as a boxer. He was one of the greatest boxers of all time. And there'd be no reason to have a Joe Louis Arena without, like, I don't know if his boxing career hinged on being from Detroit, but the fact that he was in Detroit at all hinged on the Great Migration.
And those communities you create when you have access to that movement, those enclaves that come out of the Great Migration, for example, with Harlem, different historic neighborhoods in Detroit, that can't be understated, the community you have and that you can be strengthened by when other people have shared that experience. I would be willing to put money that affected his career.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it absolutely did. And we could go on, and I actually hope to. I think you and I should make a longer episode than this. I know you have other places to be. But
I can nerd out
frequently.
So if we carve out a space, I'm so down.
But we're not nerds, because, by the way, it wasn't that long ago. This is how normal people talk. Like, you know, like, people would
I
have
could
these
cry
conversations
to think about it.
before everything is like, I've just seen this new app, you know, but I'll cut that out. People are probably listening to us on an app, so I don't want to dissuade them. But
this is sponsored by Spotify. No.
Right. It's been wonderful talking to you. And
thank you for, you know, sharing the interest in history that I have. I'm sure your students love your class.
I will, because I'm the only one here that can say so. Yes, they do.
Nice.
I love, if nothing else, I just like talking and doing this exact thing with them.
I think
so
they pick
fun.
Up. They
yeah,
pick up on
they,
it.
They do.
Yeah, it's contagious.
Yeah. Have a great rest of your time.
Please rate and follow this podcast wherever you are listening to it right now, and share with everyone you know. You can follow the Everything is a Primary Source podcast on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Show notes, which expound on each episode, and essays about history and pop culture can be found on Substack. The hub for all these things is everything-history.com. Thank you for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.